Part 2. Introduction. In Part 1 of this audiobook, I explored the science that demonstrates the role a plant-based diet rich in certain foods may play in helping to prevent, treat, and even reverse the 15 leading causes of death. For those who may have already been diagnosed with one or more of these diseases, the information in Part 1 can be life-saving. But for everyone else, perhaps those worried about inheriting a family history of illness, or who simply want their diet to promote health and longevity, the primary question might concern food choices to make day in, day out. I've given more than 1,000 presentations, and one of the most common questions I get is, "What do you eat every day, Dr. Greger?" This, Part 2 of How Not to Die, is my response to that question. I've never had so much a sweet tooth as a grease tooth. Pepperoni pizza, chicken wings by the basket, sour cream and onion potato chips, a Hardee's bacon cheeseburger nearly every day during high school, anything oily and fatty, all washed down with ice cold Dr. Pepper. Okay, maybe a little sweet tooth. I also really liked strawberry frosted donuts. Even though my grandma's miraculous recovery from heart disease inspired me to pursue a career in medicine, I didn't clean up my own diet until the publication of Dr. Ornish's landmark lifestyle heart trial in 1990. I was such a nerd in high school that I would spend my summer vacations hanging out in the science library at the local university, and there it was, published in the most prestigious medical journal in the world, proof that my family's story was not a fluke. Heart disease could be reversed. Dr. Ornish and his team had taken before and after x-rays of people's arteries, and demonstrated how they could be opened up without angioplasty, no surgery, no miracle drug, just a plant-based diet and other healthy lifestyle changes. That's what motivated me to change my own diet and ignited my 25-year love affair with nutritional science. From that point forward, I've been determined to spread the word about food's power to make you healthy, keep you healthy, and if necessary, return you to health. For the purposes of this book, I've created two simple tools to help you integrate everything I've learned into your own daily life. The first is a traffic light system to quickly identify the healthiest options, and the second is a daily dozen checklists that will help you incorporate the foods that I consider essential to the optimal diet. Make sure to check out the free app on iPhone and Android. So which foods are good for you and which are bad? Sounds like a simple enough question. In truth, it's kind of difficult to answer. I mean, whenever I'm asked at a lecture whether a certain food is healthy or not, I have to invariably reply, compared to what? For example, are eggs healthy? Well, compared to oatmeal, definitely not. But compared to the sausage links next to them on the breakfast platter, yes. What about white potatoes? They're vegetables, so they must be healthy, right? Someone asked me that a few years ago after a group of Harvard University researchers raised concern about baked and mashed potatoes. So, are they healthy? Well, compared to French fries, yes. Compared to a baked or mashed sweet potato? No, they're not. I realize these may not be satisfying answers for people who just want to know whether or not to eat the darn potato, but the only way to answer the question meaningfully is to ask what your other options are. I mean, if you're a fast food joint, a baked potato may very well be your healthiest option. Compared to what? It's not just a Socratic learning exercise I've practiced with my patients and students. Eating is essentially a zero-sum game. When you choose to eat one thing, you're generally choosing not to eat another. I'm sure you could just go hungry, but eventually your body tends to balance things out by eating more later on. So anything we choose to eat has an opportunity cost. Every time you put something in your mouth, it's a lost opportunity to put something even healthier in there. Think of it as having $2,000 in your daily calorie bank. How do you want to spend it? For the same number of calories, you can eat one Big Mac, 100 strawberries, or a 5-gallon bucket of salad. Of course, those three options don't exactly fill the same culinary niche. I mean, if you want a burger, you want a burger. I don't expect quarts of strawberries to make it on the dollar menu anytime soon, but this is an illustration of how mountainous a nutritional bang you can get for the same caloric buck. The opportunity costs exacted are not only the nutrients you could otherwise be getting, but the unhealthy components you could otherwise be avoiding. After all, when's the last time you had a friend diagnosed with kwashiorkor, or scurvy, or pellagra? These are the traditional nutrient deficiency diseases upon which the foundation of the field of nutrition was built. To this day, the nutrition and dietetic professions remain focused on what nutrients we may be lacking, but most of our chronic diseases may have more to do with what we're getting too much of. Know anyone suffering from obesity, heart disease, type 2 diabetes, or high blood pressure? A side note, isn't it expensive to eat healthfully? Researchers at Harvard University compared the cost and healthfulness of various foods across the country, hunting for the best bargains. They found that in terms of nutritional bang for your buck, people should buy more nuts, soy foods, beans, and whole grains, and less meat and dairy. They concluded, quote, "the purchase of plant-based foods may offer the best investment for dietary health," unquote. Less healthy foods only beat out healthier foods on a cost per calorie basis, which is the way we measured food cost back in the 19th century. I mean, back then, the emphasis was on cheap calories, no matter how you got them. So while beans and sugar both cost the same at the time, 5 cents a pound, the United States Department of Agriculture promoted sugar as more cost-effective for pure fuel value. The USDA can be excused for discounting the nutritional difference between beans and pure sugar. After all, vitamins hadn't even been discovered yet. Nowadays, we know better and can compare the cost of foods based on their nutritional content. An average serving of vegetables may cost roughly 4 times more than an average serving of junk food, but those veggies have been calculated to average 24 times more nutrition. So on a cost per nutrition basis, vegetables offer 6 times more nutrition per dollar compared to highly processed foods. Meat costs about 3 times more than vegetables, yet yields 16 times less nutrition based on an aggregate of nutrients. Because meat is less nutritious and costs more, vegetables net you 48 times more nutrition per dollar than meat. If your intent is to shovel as many calories as possible into your mouth for the least amount of money, then, you know, healthier foods lose out. But if you want to shove the most nutrition into your mouth as cheaply as possible, look no further than the produce aisle. Spending just 50 cents more per day on fruits and vegetables may buy you a 10% drop in mortality. Now that's a bargain. I mean, imagine if there were a pill that could reduce your chance of dying by 10% over the next decade and only had good side effects. How much do you think the drug companies would charge? Probably more than 50 cents. Dining by traffic light. The U.S. government's official Dietary Guidelines for Americans has, as of this audiobook, a chapter called Food Components to Reduce, which specifically lists added sugars, calories, cholesterol, saturated fat, sodium, and trans fat. At the same time, there are 9 so-called shortfall nutrients, of which at least a quarter of the American populace isn't reaching an adequate amount. These are fiber, the minerals calcium, magnesium, and potassium, and vitamins A, C, D, E, and K. But you don't eat food components, you eat food. There's no magnesium aisle in the grocery store, so which foods tend to have the most of the good stuff and the least of the bad? I've simplified it into a traffic light illustration that I've included in the PDF. Green light foods are unprocessed plant foods. Yellow light foods are processed plant foods and unprocessed animal foods. Red light foods are ultra-processed plant foods and processed animal foods. Just as on the road, green means go, yellow means caution, and red means stop. In this case, stop and think before you put it into your mouth. Ideally, green light foods should be maximized, yellow light foods minimized, and red light foods avoided. Is avoid too strong a word? I mean, after all, the Dietary Guidelines for Americans merely encourages you to moderate your intake of unhealthy foods. For example, eat less candy, quote-unquote. From a health standpoint, though, I mean, shouldn't you generally try to avoid candy? And public health authorities don't just advise you to smoke less tobacco, they tell you to quit. Look, they know only a small fraction of smokers will actually heed this advice, but it's the job of public health authorities to say what's best and let people make up their own minds. That's why I appreciate the American Institute for Cancer Research recommendations. Not beholden to the USDA, the AICR, the American Institute for Cancer Research, simply lays out the science. When it comes to the worst of the worst, the Institute doesn't pull any punches. Instead of the Dietary Guidelines for Americans' advice to consume fewer sodas, the AICR Cancer Prevention Guidelines advise avoid sugary drinks, period. Similarly, the AICR doesn't just say cut back on bacon, ham, hot dog, sausage, and lunch meats. The cancer guidelines tell you to avoid processed meat, period. Why? Because, quote, data do not show any level of intake that can be confidently be shown not to be associated with risk, unquote. The healthiest diet is one that maximizes the intake of whole plant foods and minimizes the intake of animal-based foods and processed junk. Simply put, eat more green light foods, eat fewer yellow light foods, and especially eat even fewer red light foods. Just like running red lights in the real world, you may be able to get away with it once in a while, but I wouldn't recommend making a habit out of it. Given this, what we've seen in the previous chapters makes a lot of sense. Unprocessed plant foods tend to have more of the protective nutrients that Americans are lacking and fewer disease-promoting factors. No wonder the eating habit apparently best able to control our epidemics of dietary disease is a whole food, plant-based diet. After all, food is a package deal. This is one of the most important concepts in all of nutrition. Yes, there's calcium in cheese, protein in pork, and iron in beef. But what about all the baggage that comes along with these nutrients? The dose of dairy hormones, the lard, the saturated fat. As much as Burger King proclaims you can have it your way, you can't go up to the counter and ask for a burger, hold the saturated fat and cholesterol. Food, indeed, is a package deal. Dairy is the number one source of calcium in the United States, but it's also the number one source of saturated fat. What kind of baggage do you get along with the calcium in green leafy vegetables? Fiber, folate, iron, and antioxidants, some of the very nutrients lacking in milk. By getting most of your nutrition from whole plant foods, you get a bonus instead of baggage. When the National Pork Board promotes ham as an excellent source of protein, I can't help but think of the famous quote from McDonald's senior vice president for marketing who, under oath in a court of law, described Coca-Cola as nutritious because it is, quote-unquote, providing water. Why don't the dietary guidelines just say no? The green light message shines brightly in pronouncements telling you to eat more fruits and vegetables. But the yellow and red lights can be dim and cloudy thanks to politics. In other words, the guidelines are clear when there is eat more messaging, eat more fresh produce. But eat less messaging is obscured into biochemical components like eat less saturated and trans fatty acids. National health authorities rarely just say to eat less meat and dairy. That's why my green light message will sound familiar to you. Oh, eat more fruits and veggies? I've heard that before. But the yellow and red light messages may sound controversial. What? Minimize meat? Really? Part of the USDA's mission is to expand markets for agricultural products. At the same time, the federal agency is tasked with protecting public health by helping to develop the dietary guidelines for Americans. That's why when those two directions are in sync, their eat more language is clear. Increase fruit intake, increase vegetable intake. But when their dual mandates are in conflict, when improving nutrition and health is at odds with promoting agricultural production, the eat less messaging of the dietary guidelines gets repackaged and ends up referring to biochemical components. Reduce intakes of solid fats, major sources of saturated and trans fatty acids, for example. What's the average consumer supposed to do with that obscure little nugget? When the guidelines tell you to eat less added sugar, calories, cholesterol, saturated fat, sodium, and trans fat, that's code for eat less junk food, less meat, less dairy, fewer eggs, and fewer processed foods. But they can't actually say that. When they did in the past, all heck broke loose. For example, when a USDA employee newsletter even suggested trying a meat-free lunch once a week as part of Johns Hopkins University School of Public Health Meatless Mondays initiative, The resulting political firestorm from the meat industry led the USDA to retract the advice just hours later. As a result of these conflicts of interest, concluded an analysis in the Food and Drug Law Journal, quote, "the guidelines sometimes favor the interests of the food and drug industries over the public's interest in accurate and impartial dietary advice," unquote. This reminds me of the landmark report on trans fat from the National Academy of Sciences Institute of Medicine, one of our most prestigious institutions. They concluded that no amount of trans fat is safe, quote, "because any incremental increase in trans fatty acid intake increases coronary heart disease risk," unquote. Since trans fats are found naturally in meat and dairy products, this places them in a quandary. Quote, "because trans fats are unavoidable in ordinary non-vegan diets, consuming 0% of energy would require significant changes in patterns of dietary intake," unquote. So if trans fats are found in meat and dairy, and the only safe intake of trans fats is zero, that means the Institute of Medicine went on to encourage everyone to start eating a plant-based diet, right? No, they did not. The director of Harvard's cardiovascular epidemiology program famously explained why. Quote, "we can't tell people to stop eating all meat and all dairy products," he said. "Well, we could tell people to become vegetarians," he added. "If we were truly basing this only on science, we would, but it is a bit extreme," unquote. We certainly wouldn't want scientists to base anything on science, now would we? A side note on how sad is the standard American diet. As cynical as I've become about diet and nutrition in this country, I was still surprised by a 2010 report from the National Cancer Institute on the status of the American diet. For example, 3 out of 4 Americans don't eat a single piece of fruit on a given day, and nearly 9 out of 10 don't reach the recommended minimum daily intake of vegetables. On a weekly basis, 96% of Americans don't reach the minimum for greens or beans, 3 servings a week for adults, 98% don't reach the minimum for orange vegetables, 2 servings a week, and 99% don't reach the minimum for whole grains, about 3 or 4 ounces a day. Then there was the junk food. The federal guidelines were so lax that up to 25% of your diet could end up being, quote-unquote, discretional calories, meaning junk. A quarter of your calories could come from cotton candy washed down with Mountain Dew, and you'd still be within the guidelines. Yet, we failed. Astoundingly, 95% of Americans exceeded their discretional calorie allowance. Only 1 in 1,000 American children between the ages of 2 and 8 made the cutoff, consuming less than the equivalent of 12 spoonfuls of sugar a day. And we wonder why there's an obesity epidemic? In conclusion, the researchers wrote, quote, "nearly the entire U.S. population consumes a diet that is not on par with recommendations." These findings add another piece to the rather disturbing picture that is emerging of a nation's diet in crisis, unquote. Producers of unhealthy commodities aren't out to make you sick. They're just trying to make a buck. Coca-Cola's profit margin, for example, is about 1/4 of the soda's retail price, making soft drink production, along with tobacco, among the most profitable industries. What's harder to understand is why the public health community isn't doing more about it. "When the history of the world's attempt to address obesity is written," wrote the head of Yale University's Rudd Center for Food Policy and Obesity, quote, "the greatest failure may be collaboration with and appeasement of the food industry," unquote. For instance, Susan G. Komen, a leading U.S. breast cancer charity, linked up with fast food giant KFC to sell pink buckets of fried chicken. Save the Children used to be a leader in the push for taxes on soda to offset some of the costs of childhood obesity. Then the organization did an abrupt 180-degree turn, withdrawing its support, saying that such campaigns no longer fit with the way that Save the Children works. Perhaps it is only a coincidence that it was seeking a grant from Coca-Cola and had already accepted a $5 million grant from Pepsi. Even though our eating habits are now killing more Americans than our smoking habits, I often hear the refrain in public health circles that we have to work with rather than against these companies because, unlike with tobacco, we don't have to smoke, but we do have to eat. Well, yes, we need to breathe, but we don't need to breathe smoked, and yes, we need to eat, but we don't need to eat junk. How do I define processed? My traffic light model stresses two important general concepts. Plant foods, with their greater protective nutritional factors and fewer disease-promoting ones, are healthier than animal foods, and unprocessed foods are healthier than processed foods. Is that always true? No. Am I saying that all plant foods are better than all animal foods? No. In fact, one of the worst items on store shelves is partially hydrogenated vegetable shortening, a product that has vegetable right in its name. Even some unprocessed plants, such as blue-green algae, can be toxic. Anyone who's had a bad case of poison ivy knows plants don't always like to be messed with. In general, though, choose plant foods over animal foods and unprocessed over processed. Michael Pollan, best-selling author of The Omnivore's Dilemma, has said, quote, "If it came from a plant, eat it. If it was made in a plant, don't." What do I mean by processed? The classic example is the milling of grains from whole wheat to white flour. Isn't it ironic that these are called refined grains, a word meaning improved or made more elegant? The elegance was not felt by the millions who died in the 19th century from beriberi, a vitamin B deficiency disease that resulted from polishing rice from brown to white. White rice is now fortified with vitamins to compensate for the refinement. A Nobel Prize was awarded for the discovery of the cause of beriberi and its cure, rice bran, the brown part of the rice that was removed. Beriberi can cause damage to the heart muscle, resulting in death from heart failure. Surely, such a thing could never happen in modern times, an epidemic of heart disease that could be prevented and cured with a change in diet? Come on. Please re-listen to Chapter 1. Sometimes, however, processing can make foods healthier. For example, tomato juice appears to be the one common juice that may actually be healthier than the whole fruit. The processing of tomato products boosts the availability of the antioxidant red pigment lycopene by as much as fivefold. Similarly, the removal of fat from cacao beans to make cocoa powder improves the nutritional profile because cocoa butter is one of the rare saturated plant fats, along with coconut and palm kernel oils, that can raise your cholesterol. So for the purposes of the traffic light model, I like to think of unprocessed as nothing bad added, nothing good taken away. In the above example, tomato juice could be thought of as relatively unprocessed because even much of the fiber is retained, unless salt is added, which would make it a processed food in my book and bump it right out of the green zone. Similarly, I would consider chocolate, but not cocoa powder, processed because sugar is added. Using my definition of nothing bad added, nothing good taken away, steel-cut oats, rolled oats, and even plain instant oatmeal can all be considered unprocessed. Almonds are obviously a whole plant food. I would also consider no-salt-added almond butter to be a green light food, but even unsweetened almond milk is a processed food, a food from which nutrition has been stolen. Am I saying almond milk is bad for you? Foods are not so much good or bad as they are better or worse. All I'm saying is that unprocessed foods tend to be healthier than processed ones. Think of it this way. Eating almonds is healthier than drinking almond milk. The limited role I see for yellow light foods in a healthy diet is to promote the consumption of green light foods. For example, if the only way I can get patients to eat oatmeal in the morning is if they make it creamy with almond milk, then I tell them, go right ahead. The same could be said for red light foods. Without hot sauce, my intake of dark green leafy vegetables would plummet. Yes, I know there's all sorts of sodium-free, exotically flavored vinegars out there I could use, and maybe one day I'll wean myself off of Tabasco, but given my current taste, the green ends justify the red means. If the only way you're going to eat a big salad is to sprinkle Bacos on top, then sprinkle away. Bacos are what are referred to as ultra-processed foods, bearing no redeeming nutritional qualities or resemblance to anything that grew out of the ground, and often containing added garbage. Bacos, for example, have added trans fat, salt, sugar, and red number 40, a food dye banned in a number of European countries. As a red light food, it ideally should be avoided, but if the alternative to your big spinach salad with Bacos is KFC, then it's better to have the salad with the Bacos. They can be the spoonful of sugar that makes the medicine go down. The same goes for real bacon bits, for that matter. I realize some people have religious or ethical objections to even trivial amounts of animal products. Growing up Jewish near the largest pig factory west of the Mississippi, I can relate to both sentiments. But from a human health standpoint, when it comes to animal products and processed foods, it's the overall diet that matters. What does whole food plant-based mean exactly? Sometimes people's diets take on a religiosity of their own. I remember a man once telling me that he could never go plant-based because he could never give up his grandma's chicken soup. Huh? Then don't! After I asked him to say hello to his bubby for me, I told him that, you know, enjoying her soup shouldn't keep him from making healthier choices the rest of the time. Right? The problem with all-or-nothing thinking is that it keeps people from even taking the first steps. The thought of never having pepperoni pizza again somehow turns into an excuse to keep ordering it every week. Why not scale down to once a month or reserve it for special occasions? We cannot let the perfect be the enemy of the good. It's really the day-to-day stuff that matters most. What you eat on special occasions is insignificant compared to what you eat day in and day out. So don't beat yourself up if you really want to put edible bacon-flavored candles on your birthday cake. I'm not making those up. Your body has a remarkable ability to recover from sporadic insults as long as you're not habitually poking it with a fork. This book is not about vegetarianism, veganism, or any other ism. There are people who completely eliminate any and all animal products as part of a religious or moral stance and may indeed end up better off as a side benefit, but strictly from a human health standpoint, you'd be hard-pressed to argue, for example, that the traditional Okinawan diet, which is 96% plant-based, is inferior to a typical Western 100% vegan diet. In Kaiser Permanente's guide, The Plant-Based Diet, A Healthier Way to Eat, the authors define a plant-based diet as one that excludes animal products completely, but they make sure to note, quote, if you cannot do a plant-based diet 100% of the time, then aim for 80%. Any movement towards more plants and fewer animal products can improve your health! Unquote. From a nutrition standpoint, the reason I don't like the terms vegetarian and vegan is that they're only defined by what you don't eat. When I used to speak on college campuses, I would meet vegans who appeared to be living off of French fries and beer. Vegan, technically, but not exactly health-promoting. That's why I prefer the term whole foods, plant-based nutrition. As far as I can discern, I mean, the best available balance of evidence suggests the healthiest diet is one centered on unprocessed plant foods. On a day-to-day basis, the more whole plant foods and the fewer processed and animal products, the better. Preparing yourself for healthier habits. First, you need to know your own psychology. There are certain personality types that do better when they go all in. If you tend to have an addictive personality, or if you're the kind of person who takes things to extremes, for instance, you either don't drink at all or you drink in excess, it's probably best for you to try to stick with the program. But some individuals can get away with quote-unquote social smoking. For example, they can light up a few times a year and escape nicotine dependence. The reason we as physicians advocate for smokers to quit completely is not because we think that one cigarette every once in a while is going to do irreversible damage, but because we're afraid that one cigarette may lead to two, and before long the unhealthy habit has taken hold. Similarly, one well-cooked hamburger is not going to kill anyone. It's what you eat day-to-day that adds up. You have to take stock of your disposition to know if you can overcome the risk of sliding down the slippery slope. There's a concept in psychology called decision fatigue that marketers use to exploit consumers. It appears humans have a limited capacity to make many decisions in a short stretch of time, and the quality of our decisions will deteriorate to the extent that we eventually begin making downright irrational choices. Ever wonder why supermarkets stack the junk food at the checkout counter? After wading through the 40,000 items in the average supermarket, we end up with less willpower to resist impulse purchases. So making rules for yourself and sticking to them may help you make more sensible choices over the long run. For instance, making a strict decision to never cook with oil, to avoid meat entirely, or to eat only whole grains may paradoxically make for sturdier life changes. By not having junk food in the house, you remove the temptation by removing the choice. I know if I get hungry enough, I'll eat an apple. There may also be physiological arguments for not wildly deviating from a well-planned diet. After a vacation cruise during which you indulged in all manner of rich foods, your palate may get dulled to a point where the natural foods you enjoyed just the week before no longer deliver the same taste satisfaction. Now, for some, this may simply require a period of readjustment. But for others, this departure from an otherwise healthy diet may lead back to a dietary rut involving added salt, sugar, and fat. For those of us who grew up eating SAD, S-A-D, the standard American diet, starting to eat healthily can be a big shift. I know it was for me. Though my mom tried to keep us eating good-for-us foods at home, when I was hanging out with friends, we'd go through boxes of Little Debbie snack cakes and indulge in greasy meals at the local Chinese restaurant where I'd order spare ribs and any other dish with chunks of deep-fried meat. One of my favorite snacks was nacho cheese-flavored Slim Jims. Thankfully, I was able to escape SAD's clutches before any overt health problems arose. That was 25 years ago. Looking back, I view that as one of the best decisions of my life. Some go cold tofu, if you will, while others transition more slowly using a variety of approaches. One I've used personally in my medical practice is Kaiser Permanente's three-step method. Realizing that most American families tend to rotate through the same 8 or 9 meals, step one suggests that you think of 3 meals you already enjoy that are plant-based, like pasta marinara sauce that could easily be tweaked to a whole grain pasta with some added veggies. Step two asks you to think of 3 meals you already eat that could be adapted to become a green light meal, like switching from beef chili to 5 bean chili. Step three is my favorite, though. Discover new healthy options. Ironically, many people following healthy diets report eating an even greater variety of foods than when they ate their former unrestricted diet. Before the widespread use of the internet, I used to tell people go to their public libraries, borrow cookbooks, but today, Google whole food plant-based recipes and a million hits pop up. If you're feeling overwhelmed, good places to start include ForksOverKnives.com. This is the site of the wildly popular documentary and book of the same name, offers hundreds of recipes. Another one is StraightUpFood.com. Cooking instructor Kathy Fisher shares more than 100 recipes on this site. And another good one, happyhealthylonglife.com. This site's tagline reads, "A Cleveland Clinic medical librarian's adventures in evidence-based living." She uses the E word. I think I'm in love. Once you've found 3 meals you enjoy and can prepare with ease, step three is complete. You now have a 9-meal rotation, and you're off. After that, moving on to breakfast and lunch is easy. If you hate to cook and just want the cheapest, easiest way to make healthy meals, I highly recommend dietitian Jeff Novick's Fast Food DVD series. Using common staples like canned beans, frozen vegetables, quick-cook whole grains, spice mixes, Jeff shows how you can feed your family healthfully in no time for about $4 a day per person. The DVDs also include grocery store walkthroughs, shopping tips, and information on how to decipher nutrition labels. Check out his cooking series at jeffnovick.com/rd/DVDs. If you crave more structure and social support, the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, PCRM, a nonprofit nutrition research and policy advocacy organization in Washington, D.C., has a fantastic 3-week Kickstart program for plant-based eating. Check it out at 21daykickstart.org. That's 21, the numerals 21daykickstart.org. This free online nutrition program starts the first of every month and offers a full meal plan, recipes, tips, resources, restaurant guide, and a community forum. As of this writing, it's offered in 4 languages. Hundreds of thousands of people have already benefited from it, so feel free to give it a try. I've always tried to get my patients to think of healthy eating as an experiment. It can be overwhelming to think of such sweeping change as permanent. That's why I ask them to give me just 3 weeks. I find that if my patients think of it simply as an experiment, they're more likely to go, whole hog or whole grain, maybe, and realize the maximum benefits. But that's really just me being sneaky. I know that once those 3 weeks are up, if they really gave it their all, they'll be feeling so much better, their lab values will be looking so much better, and their palates will have started to change. Healthy eating tastes better and better the longer you stick with it. I remember talking about this with Dr. Neil Barnard, a founding president of PCRM, which publishes a great deal of research pitting a healthy diet against a variety of common ailments, everything from acne and arthritis to menstrual cramps and migraines. He often uses what's called an ABA study design. Participants' health is assessed at baseline on their regular diets, and then they're switched to a therapeutic diet in an effort to make sure any health changes participants experience on the new diet aren't merely a coincidence. They're then switched back to the regular diet to see if the changes disappear. This kind of rigorous study design improves the validity of the results, but the problem, Dr. Barnard related, is that sometimes people improve too much. After a few weeks on a plant-based diet, sometimes people feel so much better they refuse to go back to their baseline diet, even though it's required by the study protocol. Since they didn't complete the study as planned, their data have to be effectively thrown out and may never make it into the final paper. So ironically, healthy eating can be so effective that it undermines its own studies of effectiveness. WWDGE, what would Dr. Greger eat? I'm regularly asked what I eat every day. I've always been hesitant to answer for a number of reasons. First, it shouldn't matter what I or anyone else eats, says, or does. The science is the science. You know, too much of the nutrition world is split into camps, each following their own respective guru. I mean, what other field of serious scientific inquiry is like that? I mean, after all, 2 plus 2 equals 4, regardless of what your favorite mathematician thinks. This is because there isn't a $1 trillion industry that profits from confusing people about arithmetic. If you were getting conflicting messages from all sides about basic math, in desperation, you might have to choose one authority to stick with, hoping that person will accurately represent the available research. Who has time to read and decipher all the original source material? Early on in my practice, I decided I didn't want to rely on anyone else's interpretation for what could ultimately be life-or-death decisions for my patients. Look, I had the access, the resources, and the background to interpret the science on my own. When I initially began my annual reviews of the nutrition literature, it was really just to make myself a better doctor. When I discovered such a treasure trove of information, I knew I couldn't keep it all to myself. My hope is to disseminate it in a way that removes me as much as possible from the equation. I don't want to present the trademarked Dr. Greger diet. I want to present the best available evidence diet. That's why I show the original papers, charts, graphs, and quotes with links to all the primary sources in my nutritionfacts.org videos. I try to keep my own interpretation to a minimum, though admittedly I sometimes can't help myself. What a person chooses to do with information is highly personalized and often depends on such factors as his or her current life situation and how risk-averse he or she is. I mean, given the same information, two people can make two entirely different but legitimate decisions. For this reason, I've been hesitant to share my own personal choices because I'm afraid they'll unduly sway people to make decisions that might not be right for them. I'd rather just, look, present the science and let others decide for themselves. In addition, everyone's taste buds are different. I can imagine someone thinking, he puts hot sauce on what? When people hear me talk about the wonders of hummus, which is a Middle Eastern chickpea spread, but not baba ganoush, a Middle Eastern roasted eggplant spread, they might come away with the impression that I think one's healthier than the other. This may be, and probably actually is, true, but my real reason is simple. I don't like the taste of eggplant. Conversely, just because I eat something doesn't mean it's healthy. For example, people are surprised to hear I use Dutched cocoa, alkali processed cocoa. In that process, more than half of the antioxidants and flavanol phytonutrients are wiped out. Why would I use it then? Because it tastes so much better to me than unprocessed cocoa. So while I encourage people to use natural cocoa, I don't take my own advice in that regard. In some cases, it would be better if people would do as I say, not as I do. And what if I shared a recipe that someone found utterly repulsive? I mean, I would hate for him or her to think, if this is eating healthy, count me out. As you eat healthier, your palate actually changes. It's an amazing phenomenon. Your taste buds are constantly adapting. In fact, minute to minute, if you drink some orange juice right now, it would taste sweet. But if you first ate some candy and then drank the same OJ, it would taste unpleasantly bitter. And over the long term, the more you eat healthier, the better healthy foods taste. I remember the first time I sipped a green smoothie. I was speaking somewhere in Michigan, hosted by a darling physician couple. They told me that they drank blended salads for breakfast. Now, intellectually, I love the idea, right? Greens, the healthiest food on the planet, in convenient liquid form. You know, I envision myself, you know, drinking a salad on my way to work every morning, you know. But then I tasted it. It felt like I was drinking someone's lawn. I gagged and almost threw up all over my host's kitchen table. Green smoothies are something you definitely have to build up to. I mean, everyone loves fruit smoothies, right? Frozen bananas, strawberries, yum. Okay. And surprisingly, you can throw a handful of baby spinach in there, and you may hardly even taste it. Give it a try. You'd be surprised. Okay, so if one handful is good, how about two? Or slowly, your taste buds can adapt to increasing quantities of greens. This happens with all your senses. You know, walk into a dark room, and your eyes will slowly adapt. Stick your foot in a hot bath, and although at first it might be too hot, your body equilibrates to a new normal. Likewise, a couple weeks, you can be drinking and enjoying concoctions you now consider absolutely wretched. Having said all that, I will now proceed to tell you what I eat, what I drink, what I do, and how I do it. In each subsequent chapter, I'll dive deeper into each of the entries on my Daily Dozen checklist to describe which types of these green light foods are my favorite, as well as the tricks and techniques I use to prepare them. I won't be detailing every type of bean, fruit, vegetable, nut, and spice that I eat, but my goal here is rather to explore some of the interesting science behind a few of my favorite options in each category. Please understand that my strategy is a way to do it rather than the way to do it. If it happens to work for you, great. If not, I hope you'll explore the myriad other ways you could use the same body of evidence to help improve and prolong your life.